See, our speaker here this evening is Brother Malcolm Shovock, and he's to speak to us on the subject of Nebuchadnezzar's pride. And he's asked, as a suitable introduction, we take Daniel chapter 3. Daniel chapter 3. Nebuchadnezzar the king made an image of gold, whose height was 70 cubits, and the breadth thereof 6 cubits. He set it up in the plain of Dura, in the province of Babylon. Then Nebuchadnezzar the king sent to gather together the princes, the governors, the captains, the judges, the treasurers, the counselors, the sheriffs, and all the rulers of the provinces to come to the dedication of the image which Nebuchadnezzar the king had set up. Then the princes, the governors and captains, the judges, the treasurers, the counselors, the sheriffs, and all the rulers of the provinces were gathered together unto the dedication of the image that Nebuchadnezzar the king had set up. And they stood before the image that Nebuchadnezzar had set up. Then an herald cried aloud, "To you it is commanded, O people, nations, and languages, that at what time you hear the sound of the cornet, flute, harp, sackbut, psaltery, dulcimer, and all kinds of music, you fall down and worship the golden image that Nebuchadnezzar the king hath set up. And whosoever falleth not down and worshipeth shall the same hour be cast into the midst of a burning fiery furnace." Therefore, at that time, when all the people heard the sound of the cornet, flute, harp, sackbut, psaltery, and all kinds of music, all the people, the nations and languages, fell down and worshipped the golden image that Nebuchadnezzar the king had set up. Wherefore, at that time, certain Chaldeans came near and accused the Jews. They spake and said to the king Nebuchadnezzar, "O king, live forever. Thou, O king, hast made a decree that every man shall hear the sound of the cornet, flute, harp, sackbut, psaltery, and dulcimer, and all kinds of music, shall fall down and worship the golden image. And whoso falleth not down and worshippeth, that he should be cast into the midst of a burning fiery furnace. There are certain Jews whom thou hast set over the affairs of the province of Babylon, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. These men, O king, have not regarded thee. They serve not thy gods, nor worship the golden image which thou hast set up." Then Nebuchadnezzar, in his rage and fury, commanded to bring Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. Then they brought these men before the king. Nebuchadnezzar spake and said unto them, "Is it true, O Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, do you not serve my gods, nor worship the golden image which I have set up? Now if you be ready, that at what time you hear the sound of the cornet, flute, harp, sackbut, psaltery, and dulcimer, and all kinds of music, you fall down and worship the image which I have made, well. But if you worship not, you shall be cast the same hour into the midst of a burning fiery furnace. Who is that God that shall deliver you out of my hands?" Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego answered and said to the king, "O Nebuchadnezzar, we are not careful to answer thee in this matter. If it be so, our God whom we serve is able to deliver us from the burning fiery furnace, and he will deliver us out of thine hand, O king. But if not, be it known unto thee, O king, that we will not serve thy gods, nor worship the golden image which thou hast set up." Then was Nebuchadnezzar full of fury, and the form of his visage was changed against Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. Therefore he spake and commanded that they should heat the furnace 7 times more than it wont to be heated. And he commanded the most mighty men that were in his army to bind Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, and to cast them into the burning fiery furnace. Then these men were bound in their coats, their hosen, and their hats, and their other garments, and were cast into the midst of the burning fiery furnace. Therefore, because the king's commandment was urgent, and the furnace exceeding hot, the flame of the fire slew those men that took up Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. And these three men, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, fell down bound into the midst of the burning fiery furnace. Then Nebuchadnezzar the king was astonished, and rose up in haste, and spake, and said unto his counsellors, "Did we not cast three men bound into the midst of the fire?" They answered and said, "True, O king." He answered and said, "Lo, I see four men loose, walking in the midst of the fire. They have no hurt. And the form of the fourth is like the Son of God." Then Nebuchadnezzar came near to the mouth of the burning fiery furnace and spake and said, "Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, ye servants of the Most High God, come forth, come hither." Then Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego came forth of the midst of the fire. And the princes, governors, and captains, and the king's counselors, being gathered together, saw these men, upon whose bodies the fire had no power, nor was an hair of their head singed, neither were their coats changed, nor the smell of fire had passed on them. Then Nebuchadnezzar spake and said, "Blessed be the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, who has sent his angel and delivered his servants that trusted in him, and have changed the king's word and yielded their bodies, that they might not serve nor worship any god except their own God. Therefore I make a decree that every people, nation, and language which speak anything amiss against the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego shall be cut in pieces, and their houses shall be made a dunghill, because there's no other God that can deliver after this sort." Then the king promoted Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego in the province of Babylon. It's now my pleasure then to ask Brother Malcolm to speak to us on Nebuchadnezzar's pride.
Well, good evening, everyone. Brothers and sisters, when Daniel and his three friends were carried away to Babylon in the third year of King Jehoiakim, if Nebuchadnezzar was not already a proud man, then he would certainly begin to develop into one through his later victories. If he was, it would increase greatly over the next few years. The little kingdom of Judah had been overrun, the cream of the nation skimmed off to learn the ways of Babylon. A year after Daniel and his company had arrived in Babylon, Nebuchadnezzar won one of the greatest battles in history, when he defeated Pharaoh Necho at the Battle of Carchemish. And the record states in the Second of Kings that the king of Egypt came not again any more out of his land, for the king of Babylon had taken from the river of Egypt unto the river of Euphrates all that pertained to the king of Egypt. Moreover, it is recorded in Ezekiel that because of his service against Tyre, God said about this king, "Behold, I will give the land of Egypt unto Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, and he shall take her multitude and take her spoil and take her prey, and it shall be the wages of his army." What would he find in Egypt? Statues on a grand scale, treasures in abundance, skills of the craftsman to be greatly desired. But his pride would take a giant leap when he was informed by Daniel in the second chapter of Daniel, through his dream, that he was the head of gold. And he wasn't going to be outdone by anyone. And no God was going to be greater than his God. You know, in the early parts of the 19th century, critics of the Bible said there'd never been such a king as Nebuchadnezzar, and there'd never been such a place as Babylon. And then the archaeologists found it. And it was calculated that it took 8,750 million bricks to make it. And his name was stamped on every brick. Now that's some evidence. Now this image that was set up in the plains of Jura, it's not to be thought of as solid gold. It was 60 cubits high. That's 30 meters high. And to give you some appreciation of scale, a normal house is about 7 meters. Well, mine is anyway, because I measured it. So we are looking at something like a 10-story block of flats in height. But its width was only 6 cubits. That's 3 meters wide. It was an impossible structure to be of solid gold. It must have been of some other material overlaid with gold. Because the quantities, if it were solid, would be just too astounding. Assuming it was circular, it required 5,785 and a half cubic feet. And there are 17,000 ounces of gold in a cubic foot. But those weren't the figures that astounded me. But these. It would have taken 8,262,806 pounds, 10 ounces of gold. That's almost 3,000 ton. It would have been impossible if it was solid gold. But it was those figures that took my breath away. It must have been an image, either of himself or of some god he'd got, overlaid with gold. Because we need to recognize everything about Nebuchadnezzar was grandiose. Is not this great Babylon that I have built for the house of the kingdom of, by the might of my power and for the honor of my majesty? He says in the fourth chapter and in verse 30. The walls of his city, the gardens of his palace, the image of his God. He would not suffer the thought of being exceeded in any direction. And the object of this image was to astound the nations which he had conquered. All those nations were now under his control. Look at verse 4. Then an herald cried aloud, "To you it is commanded, O people, nations, and languages." Everybody concerned. And they'd got to bow down to this image. And the Aramaean means it was a likeness. Now, that could mean it was a likeness of himself or a likeness of one of his gods. But however we view it, it was to show off the pride of Babylon and the glory of its king. But way before these events, the prophet Jeremiah had foretold of the futility of idols. I'm going to Jeremiah chapter 10. And we're just going to look at one verse, which is verse 11. Thus shall ye say unto them, the gods that have not made the heavens and the earth, even they shall perish from the earth and from under these heavens. Now the interesting thing about this particular verse, and only this verse in Jeremiah, according to my margin, it's the one verse written in Aramaic. It's written in the language that the nations would use so they could clearly understand it. It was directed also to the Babylonians. This might seem an aside, but would you turn to Acts 14? And you'll see how the Apostle Paul uses exactly this same principle. And I'm going to tell you why in a minute. This is when the Apostle Paul cured a man at Lystra who was impotent in his feet. We pick that up in verse 8. There sat a certain man at Lystra, impotent in his feet, being crippled from his mother's womb and never had walked. And Paul cures him. And verse 11, and when the people saw what Paul had done, they lifted up their voice, saying, in the speech of Lycaonia. You see, they'd crossed into an area which was another language. So they say it in their language, in the speech of Lycaonia, the gods are come down to us in the likeness of men. And they called Barnabas Jupiter, and Paul they called Mercurius, because he was the chief speaker. But verse 14, which when the apostles Barnabas and Paul heard of, they rent their clothes, ran in among the people, crying out and saying, sirs, why do ye these things? We also are men of like passions with you, and preach unto you that, and this is the point, this is where he's quoting Jeremiah, that you should turn from these vanities unto the living God, which made heaven and earth and the sea and all things that are therein. Now if they spoke in the speech of Lycaonia, so would the Apostle Paul, because he got the spirit gifts to talk different languages. So he would have spoken in the speech of Lycaonia, so they could understand him. And he's telling them exactly the same thing, to turn from idols, just as Jeremiah did. Now when we go back to Daniel 3, or rather, just before Daniel 3, and look at verse 4 of the second chapter. Then spake the Chaldean to the king in Syriac. Now, that's Aramaic in the margin. And from verse 4 of Daniel chapter 2 to the end of chapter 7 is written in Aramaic. And it's written in that language so Babylon can understand exactly what's being said. And it's all about turning to God from these idols, particularly in this third chapter. But there's another aspect concerning Babylon's false gods, I wish to point out before we come to Nebuchadnezzar's personal pride. Each of these four named Israelis, these young captives, were given Babylonian names. Daniel's was Belteshazzar, Hananiah was Shadrach, Mishael was Meshach, and to Azariah was given the name of Abednego. And each of these names have an association with Babylonian gods. But have you ever thought of this strange situation? That Daniel, to this day, is known the world over by his Hebrew name, and the other three are known by the Babylonian names. I reckon not one person in 10 who passes this hall would know Daniel's Babylonian name or the Hebrew names of the other three. Well, perhaps that's a bit conservative. Say 1 in 1,000 wouldn't know. And although nowadays it is possible to translate and explain thousands of Babylonian names, apparently there is still a difficulty with the names of Shadrach, Meshach. But Abednego is clear. It means servant of Nebo. The Babylonian idol That is mentioned in Isaiah 46. You'll remember the words, Bel boweth down, Nebo stoopeth. But there's a slight change between Nebo and Nego. We know here he's called Abed-Nego. But it is possibly a deliberate alteration by the writer of the book, who was thinking of the command way back in the law to break the heathen idols into pieces. Have a look at Deuteronomy chapter 12. And we're going to read we're going from verse 1. These are the statutes and judgments which ye shall observe to do in the land which the Lord God of thy fathers giveth thee to possess it, all the days that ye live upon the earth. Ye shall utterly destroy all the places wherein the nations which ye shall possess served their gods, upon the high mountains and upon the hills and under every green tree. And ye shall overthrow their altars, break down their pillars, burn their groves with fire, and ye shall hew down the graven images of their gods, and destroy the names of them out of that place. Now these young men, these three young men, had no power at all to do that. No power in the present circumstances to break down their images in that sense. Although we shall see presently just how they did destroy them. And yet the writer did mutilate their names to such an extent that the other two names cannot be identified with any certainty of which pagan deity Shadrach and Meshach represented. And the reason I believe we have these names as they are is that in the record, Daniel was never in confrontation with these false gods directly. If you look back at the second chapter and at verse 49, we will find when Daniel is promoted, it says, Daniel requested of the king, and he said, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego over the affairs of the province of Babylon. But Daniel sat in the gate of the king. So they were away in the provinces, whereas Daniel was actually in the city. He wasn't involved in this incident. His focus was altogether in a different area, which we shall just look at briefly a bit later on. Whereas his three friends were directly challenged by this setting up of this image, upon which hearing the music of the instruments mentioned had to fall down and worship. Now these captive princes, having been given the privilege of every luxury in Babylon. Because we need to remember, these Babylonians were not only warriors, they were also scholars. And these three, along with Daniel, had been placed in the palace school as foreign students. And as royal children, they were not only to learn the wisdom, the knowledge and the science of their captors, but all of it was designed for them to become Babylonian. This is the reason for it. Just go back to the first chapter for a minute. Just pick this up. Verse 4 of chapter 1. Children in whom was no blemish, but well favoured, skilled in wisdom and cunning, in knowledge and understanding science, and such had ability in them to stand in the king's palace, and whom they might teach the learning and the tongue of the Chaldeans. That was the point of it. They were to to learn the learning in the tongue of the Chaldeans. In the ancient East, a new name meant a new identity. And a Babylonian name thus indicated a Babylonian identity. But the added honor of these names represented Babylonian gods. But now they insult their captors. And there's no other word for it. They insult their captors by not bowing down to its gods. And in effect, refusing to be anything but Jewish. Now we need to reflect on the faith of these and courage of these young men. Not only had they been transported to a strange land at a very early age, probably early teenage years, but they are faced with practices and customs that to them, which it would go against the grain of everything they'd ever been taught. And what they'd been brought up to do was revere God. We don't know if their parents were still alive. What we do know is that subsequently, and by the subsequent actions, is the manner of their upbringing. It might help us to reflect on how children are best taught. And I can put it no better than Alfred Edersheim does, as he does in his book, The Life and Times of Jesus the Messiah. And I quote, "Education begins at home. It is imparted by influence and example before it comes by teaching. It is acquired by what is seen and heard before it is laboriously learned from books. Its real object becomes instinctively felt before its goal is consciously sought." That was Edersheim. Very much like Moses, actually, when it's recorded in the 7th chapter of the Acts of the Apostles, he says, "He was learned in all the wisdom of the Egyptians and was mighty in word and deed." Nevertheless, when it come to making a decision as to which side he would place his loyalty, he was influenced by the instructions of his mother. And it's the same here with Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. Babylon could change their names. It could give them a Babylonian education. It could clothe them in the Babylonian fashion. But their early Jewish training was to be their guide through life, even if their lives were to be cut short. It's a lesson to consider on how perhaps we educate our own children. But now, by their actions, they are to destroy this image, not in the prescribed manner as we read in Deuteronomy, but demonstrating the futility and the ineffectiveness of such idols. Now we can see the character of Nebuchadnezzar in all its aspects in the early parts of Daniel, because he comes across as regal, masterful, and determined. When Daniel interprets his dream, he lavishes him with gifts. There's nothing stinted or measured about Nebuchadnezzar. But when his anger's roused, he is full of fury. In the second chapter, he says, "If you can't interpret this dream, your houses are going to be made a dunghill and you're going to be executed." Simple as that. No ifs, buts, or maybes. That was it. How could anyone then dare to oppose the king's commandment? Because the punishment is spelt out. Verse 5. "At what time you hear the sound of the cornet, the flute, the harp, the sackbut, the psaltery, the dulcimer, and all kinds of music, ye fall down and worship the golden image that Nebuchadnezzar the king had set up. And whoso falleth not down and worshipeth shall the same hour be cast into the midst of a burning fiery furnace. It's repeated again in verse 11. Refusal was merciless death. Now we have to say rivalry and jealousy played its part in all of this. These certain Chaldeans who report to the king that there are Jews in their province who will not bow down to it. Possibly they resented the fact that these Jews were in a better and higher position than themselves. They may well have thought to themselves, what's the king playing at, putting these Jews above us? But they dare not say it, not to this king. But the minute there's an opportunity, they take it. Verse 12. There are certain Jews whom thou hast set over the affairs of the province of Babylon, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. These men, O king, have not regarded thee. They serve not thy gods, nor worship the golden image which thou hast set up. Thy God, aren't they the gods of these Babylonians as well? But they simply say, thy gods. And the anger of the king, although it is instant, nevertheless, it seems that he's got a certain regard for these young men, because he gives them an ample opportunity to change their minds and fall in line with his commandment. Verse 14. Nebuchadnezzar spake and said unto them, is it true, O Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, do ye not serve my gods, nor worship the golden image which I have set up? Now if ye be ready that at what time ye hear the sound of the cornet, flute, harp, sackbut, psaltery, dulcimer, and all kinds of music, ye fall down and worship the image which I have made, well, you know, we'll forget it. But if ye worship not, ye shall be cast into the midst of the burning fiery furnace. And here's the point. And who is that God that can deliver you out of my hands? As if to say, come on, lads, forget your Jewishness, you're Babylonians now. But no amount of influence, charm, or favour would induce them to deny their nationality or loyalty to their God. And neither would threats. And their reply seems very calm and measured. I believe it was in the same spirit as when they stood with Daniel in the first chapter to make request unto Melzar. Let's just go back to the first chapter a minute and verse 11. Because we know they'd prayed about it, the four of them. Then said Daniel to Melzar, whom the prince of the eunuchs had set over Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, prove thy servants, I beseech thee, 10 days, and let them give us pulse to eat and water to drink. And then see the result. That's what they're asking. They'd purposed in their hearts not to defile themselves, but they make a request. That's all. They simply make a request. Many years ago, I remember listening to an address by Brother Cyril Tennant, who was expounding the phrase from Jude that we should earnestly contend for the faith. But he made the point that we should do it without being contentious. You see, contentious is being quarrelsome. We can contend for the faith, but we haven't got to be contentious about it. Well, they made a request back then in the first chapter, using themselves as a test case and putting the matter in the hands of God through prayer, and it would be the same now. But the words to focus on and probably underline are verse 17 and 18, because this is their reply. If it be so, our God, whom we serve, is able to deliver us from the burning fiery furnace, and he will deliver us out of thine hand, O king. But if not, be it known unto thee, O king, that we will not serve thy gods, nor worship the golden image which thou hast set up. Our God is able, they said. But if not, they're still not going to budge from their position. And because his pride was dented, the king's anger knew no bounds. Heating the furnace 7 times hotter wouldn't have made any difference to the result. Wrapping them in every garment they could physically put on, as we read in verse 19, wouldn't have made any difference to the outcome. This was simply blind rage on the part of the king. The only thing it did achieve was for the king to lose some of his mighty men, because when they cast them into the furnace, it burnt them. But there's one other thought regarding these young men. How would they feel? Not knowing whether God would or would not deliver them at this time. Because that was the issue. God would deliver them at the resurrection, they were sure of that. And I suspect he will call them from the grave by their Jewish names, not their Babylonian names. But what might have gone through, given them some anxiety, was their knowledge of the law. You see, burning as a punishment in the law was for gross iniquity. I'll just quote you these passages. It's in Leviticus 20. If a man take a wife and her mother, it is wickedness. They shall be burned with fire, both he and they, that there be no wickedness among you. In chapter 21 of Leviticus, it says, and the daughter of any priest, if she profane herself by playing the whore, she profaneth her father, she shall be burnt with fire. But now that method of punishment is to be applied to these three young lads for complete faithfulness. It must have crossed their minds. But if not, they said, if at this time God saw fit to allow them to be martyred, yet they would still trust him. And yet we need to see this deliverance in the purpose of God. If Israel were being carried away to this idol-ridden nation for their punishment through their iniquity, captivity would not have been a remedy if it made obedience impossible. Way back in the land, Jeremiah had to contend with the thoughts that those left behind were the favorite ones, and those taken captive, the guilty ones. Let's remind ourselves, Jeremiah 24. Verse 1, the Lord showed me, and behold, 2 baskets of figs were set before the temple of the Lord. After that, Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, had carried away captives Jeconiah, the son of Jehoiakim, king of Judah, and the princes of Judah, with the carpenters and the smiths from Jerusalem, and had brought them to Babylon. 1 basket had very good figs, even like the figs that are first ripe. And the other basket had very naughty figs, or bad figs, which could not be eaten, they were so bad. Then said the Lord unto me, what seest thou, Jeremiah? And I said, figs, the good figs, very good, and the evil figs, very evil. That cannot be eaten, they are so evil. And the word of the Lord came unto me, saying, thus saith the Lord, the God of Israel, like those good figs, so will I acknowledge them that are carried away captive of Judah, whom I have sent out of this place into the land of the Chaldeans for their good. Notice that last phrase. It was for their good. These idols had to be destroyed before the next wave of captives arrive in Babylon. Destroyed as effectively and as efficiently as that passage in Deuteronomy that we looked at. And looking into the furnace, no doubt, to gloat that his God was superior, was then surprised to find that the God of Israel had sent his angel to protect them. Heat that was hot enough to melt steel had no effect on them. All it did was burn the bonds with which they were bound. And when returning out of the furnace, there was not even so much as the smell of fire upon them. Now, we've all been to bonfires, haven't we? Probably took our children. And you know what it's like when you come back from a bonfire. And if you sisters are anything like my wife, she always used to say to the kids, get them clothes off and get in the wash and get in the shower, because even the smoke's on your hair before you get into bed. That was the problem. The smoke sticks to you. But it didn't with these. God had delivered them. The power of Babylon's idols had been destroyed. Verse 27. And the princes, governors, and captains, and the king's counselors, being gathered together, saw these men upon whose bodies the fire had no power, nor was an hair of their head singed, neither were their coats changed, nor the smell of fire had passed upon them. Then Nebuchadnezzar spake and said, blessed be the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, who has sent his angel and delivered his servants that trusted in him, and have changed the king's word, and yielded their bodies, that they might not serve nor worship any god except their own God. All the people witnessed all the importance of the land, and it was settled once and for all. And here's the reason for it. So that when the bulk of the nation is carried away to Babylon, what do they find? In charge of them are those of their own nation, because he places over them. Verse 30, then the king promoted Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego in the province of Babylon. So when the later wave of captives come, their own nation are over them, who through their faithfulness and courage had changed the established regulations of the mighty Babylonian Empire. So they can keep their own dietary laws. That's what they established in the first chapter. And they are free now to worship their own God, the Lord their God, as he prescribed through these three faithful young men. And to help those who were being carried off into Babylon, well, there's a faithful priest by the name of Ezekiel to direct and instruct them. So Deuteronomy 4 comes into play. Remember these words. Keep therefore and do them. He's referring to the law. For this is your wisdom and your understanding in the sight of the nations, which shall hear all these statutes and say, surely this great nation is a wise and understanding people. For what nation is there so great, who hath God so nigh unto them as our God is in all things that we call upon him for? Whatever else the nation revered, such as the temple and the altar and the ritual, all that was now gone while they were in Egypt, while they were in Babylon, for a time. Even their music ceased. How can we sing the Lord's song in a strange land, says Psalm 137. But the moral law was never to be set aside. And in the purpose of God, through these brave young men, it was upheld throughout their captivity until the time came that they were returned back to their own land. And the very last words of Nebuchadnezzar, this proud king, are very revealing. Now I, Nebuchadnezzar, praise and extol and honour the King of heaven, all whose works are truth, and his ways judgment, and all those that walk in pride he is able to abase. And those are the last words of Nebuchadnezzar. So much so that it has led some to believe that the king of Babylon was converted to the Lord God. And if that is true, what a remarkable sight it will make when in the kingdom one of the greatest kings that ever lived on this earth bows in reverence to the King of Kings. So I'd like to close with a poem, and it's called Saint's Surprise. It says, I dreamed Messiah came last night. The kingdom doors flew wide. An angel dressed in shining white escorted me inside. And there, to my astonishment, were folks I'd always labelled as quite unfit, of little worth, and spiritually disabled. Indignant words rose to my lips, but never were set free. For every face bore stunned surprise. No one expected me.